Hello, rich girls. Welcome back to Old Money, the podcast to help you build the trust funds we wish we were born with. We have a very special episode today for women who identify as children of immigrants. If you are a first-generation American, you will know that there is a unique type of pressure that comes with being the first to be born here, the first to graduate, the first to earn a corporate salary, or the first to understand credit, investing, retirement accounts. And often you're the first to carry all the financial weight of your entire family. So for many first-generation women, money is not just math, it's cultural. It's about loyalty. It can be about love and guilt and pride. It's about expectation. Today, I'm joined by Giovanna Gonzalez, or Gigi, as she goes by. She's the author of Cultura and Cash, and she also has a podcast of the same name. She unpacks all of the invisible responsibilities she's taken on as a first-generation daughter, also a first-born daughter. She talks all about the financial scripts that we inherit, these expectations, but most importantly, the practical steps that women can take to build stability and boundaries and long-term wealth without losing themselves in the process or really breaking cultural expectations and maintaining that familial bond of their culture. If you've ever felt torn between being a good daughter and becoming financially independent, this episode is for you. Let's get into it. Okay, Gigi, you are a first-generation Mexican-American, am I right?
Yes.
Okay, so what event in your life or what happened in your family that made you go, huh, something's going on here with my family and money and I need to look into it?
I laugh because the events were constant family drama over money. And I didn't understand why they were happening because I was doing money according to the financial books that I'd read on personal finance, which were mostly written by white male. And from an American point of view, so I found it very confusing. I'm like, I'm doing things by the book according to what the experts are saying, but I am getting slammed by my family. And they're like, we don't do money this way. So that's when I'm like, there's something here. There's like a culture clash and I don't really know how to navigate it. But as a bicultural Latina, somebody that is both American and both Mexican, I had to learn how to juggle both.
What was the drama about? Like, what were some of the expectations your family had that you were not reading from Dave Ramsey, Susie Orman?
Yeah, Dave Ramsey and Susie Orman never talked about what I should do when my mom needed an emergency hysterectomy, did not have health insurance or an emergency fund or any sort of savings to pay for it herself. So her only viable option was to go to Mexico and get it much cheaper, but it was still $7,000. And the way that medical procedures work in Mexico, they don't do the procedure and bill you later. You have to pay up front. That was hard to navigate because obviously I was concerned about my mom's health and I wanted to help, but I also had already had conflict with my mom about her not paying me back for other things. So I'm like, I didn't have the money, first of all, so I was going to have to charge it on a credit card. And that was my concern. What if she stops making payments and she's like, oh, she'll figure it out. She'll pay for it because she wants to keep a good credit score and then just leave me hanging. So that was difficult to navigate.
I am half Latin. My mom was born in El Salvador. She moved to the U.S. when she was 11. My grandmother worked as a line cook in a hotel in San Francisco her whole life. And my father, his parents were both from Holland, and my grandmother was a prisoner of war in World War II. She was Jewish. Oh, so we all have these money stories that are like passed down to us, right? And just the way that we learn to cope. So what have you seen from especially Mexican-American or Latin first-gen families that are, like you mentioned, mom needs surgery, like we have to contribute, or I've already lent my mom money. What are some unspoken agreements around money in Latin families?
Yeah. So what I see a lot is definitely the theme of financial trauma or financial anxiety, either due to them experiencing food scarcity or having to rely on social programs. Maybe their family dealt with deportation, so that sudden hit of a lost income stream. So that is something that I find that my readers and followers need to grapple with first, because it really can be a block to embracing financial wellness if all you've known is scarcity and chaos. Another theme I see a lot, we inherit this mistrust from financial institutions. And I talk about that in the book about how a lot of our parents that immigrated from Latin American countries, you know, they maybe didn't have the best financial system. Maybe the interest rates were incredibly high, volatile. Maybe their currency, right, was also volatile. So
yeah,
they rather just kind of keep their money in cash. And that's something that we have to unlearn too.
Yeah. And tell us about your family structure. Like, do you have brothers and sisters? Who in your family is around and how did that show up for you?
Yeah. So I am the oldest of three and I have two brothers. So I'm the boss.
Yes, girl.
I'm the boss. And my mom and my dad have had a very volatile relationship. So my dad was in my life from, let's say, age 6 to 16 when they divorced for good. It was amicable at first, then it wasn't, and it still isn't. So I come from divorced parents, but I always grew up around a lot of love. My grandparents really stepped up during that period from age 1 to 6 before I met my dad. We live with my grandparents, so I feel very indebted to them.
So what is that like to be not only a first-gen daughter, but the eldest daughter in the family? Did you feel a lot of pressure once you started to make money? How did that materialize for you?
Yeah, absolutely. Even while being in college, I felt the pressure. I went to a community college first, then I transferred to UC Santa Barbara. And once I transferred, I definitely felt this really self-imposed pressure of, oh, you're making something out of yourself. And what you've seen modeled in life is always giving back to family. Mm-hmm. And even though I was living off student loans and working a minimum wage job as a waitress, I felt that I had to help my mom, who was recently a single mom, right, because of this divorce. So I helped her at the time by paying her car insurance bill and her phone bill, which I think it amounted to, let's say, a little bit over $100. It doesn't sound like much, but again, when you are living off student loans.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, my mom never had the wherewithal to say, wait, don't you need to spend money on your books? She figured I had the money and I was being a good daughter, just the way that we were taught in our family. So I felt that pressure. I remember also having a conversation with my boss at one of my internships because I think she was going through a rough patch, obviously because of the divorce, but I think also menopause, a bunch of things. So she had quit her job, was living off her very measly 401k. She just emptied it all out and was living off that because, again, she didn't have savings.
Yeah.
And then I felt this pressure of once I graduate, I have to make good money to help my mom out. And Sergio, he's Latino too, and he's Mexican American, was the name of my internship boss. And he said, Giovanna, you are the child. She is a mom. And I was so insulted. I was like, how dare you? Like, I didn't tell him, right? But I thought internally, how dare you? This is my mother. I have to do whatever I do. My thoughts on that have changed drastically, which we can talk about. And it's something that I discussed more in the book. But that was the only person really that was telling me, oh, you know, you can break the rules or you can do things differently and that's okay, or this responsibility doesn't fall on you, especially during this time when you're a college student just figuring it all out.
Right. Did you have friends at the time that knew that you were helping your mom out, or was this something that was just with the family? And did you have other friends that were helping their parents out? Like, did you know anything about that?
Yeah. So I definitely had friends that were helping their family too. So it felt normal.
It felt normal.
Yeah. I was very involved in a campus organization. It was called the Latino Business Association. We had weekly meetings and a lot of those people became my close friends. Mm-hmm. And we would confide in each other. I know that one friend paid for half his mom's rent while he was in college.
Wow.
Yeah. So for me, $100 seemed like little compared to what others were doing.
Right.
And then I saw also more of my white counterparts. They're having their parents pay for school, giving them allowances for them to go through college and not have to worry about working a job and just focusing on school and getting good grades. So I saw the contrast in college for sure.
Yeah. When you started to kind of change your thoughts around it, did you ever experience feelings of resentment? Whether it's like, why didn't my mom have the education around finances, or why should I be doing this? Like, what were the emotions you were feeling?
The resentment was definitely towards white people, I will admit.
Yeah.
Tell me about that. Or to more privileged people. At the time, I did not resent my family because that's just how things were done.
Yeah.
The resentment came later with my family. That came about from, again, me being obedient, doing the good daughter thing and providing financial support because that was expected of me. But then when the roles were reversed and I was in financial distress and I needed help, my family was too broke to help. So that's when I found, oh, this goes one way. It doesn't go both ways. And that's what I didn't think was fair. And of course, they couldn't provide support because, hello, that's why they needed help from me, right?
Yeah.
So that's when I kind of realized, okay, like I'm their safety net, but who's my safety net? And that's when I learned I had to be create my own safety net.
Girl, yeah. And like, can we unpack this good daughter thing too? Because whether it's the good daughter in the family or the good girl, I mean, you have this incredible book that I just devoured and listened to. I think that was one of the things that stood out to me so much of like kind of reflecting back on myself of that internal drive that I had to like be good. What was that for you? And how did you unpack that?
I mean, again, my mom never explicitly told me pay for my car insurance, pay for my phone bill. Some of my friends, their parents did. But once I graduated and I did have that white collar job working in an office, they see that as financial success. They don't realize that I had to take out so many loans to even be in that space, right?
Right.
I remember one time my grandma, so again, I grew up with my grandparents, so I feel very grateful for our relationship. What I had seen modeled was my aunts and uncles giving money to my grandparents because we knew they didn't have a bunch saved. So I started giving out my grandma, again, she never asked for it, but I started giving out a small allowance, $50 a month. And I remember I switched jobs and my pay decreased by about $12,000. So I had a frank conversation with her and I said, hey, Nana, I'm not going to be able to give you this $50 a month. And she said, oh, I understand. Thank you. I appreciate that you helped. But then a year or two later, my finances got better because I switched jobs again. And I started doing a little traveling. And I remember getting a message from my grandma saying, hey, mija, you know, I see you've been doing a lot of traveling now. So can we go back to that allowance you were giving? And I'm laughing because I'm looking at your face.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I didn't like the approach. And me and my grandma are close. Yeah. So I just told her, grandma, just because you're seeing me live my life a little bit more doesn't mean that I still don't have a bunch of debt and doing this. I'm like, I will help you again when I can. And I did that. So most recently, I would say in my mid-30s, my grandparents needed help with a medical aid. Is that the word? Like a nurse, at home nurse?
Sure. Yeah.
And that was $300 a month. So now I'm thankful that I'm in a position where I can give that kind of money when I want. Mm-hmm. But again, when my situation changes, when I moved internationally and incurred a lot of expenses with the immigration lawyers and the moving costs, I had that conversation again of, hey, my finances are changing and I'm going to remove this support. And they were grateful for me to have help for the time that I could.
I'm so excited. And we're going to get to, I mean, how you became a boundaried boss and like all the things that you did to start to take care of yourself too. But I just find it so fascinating because all of our families are built so differently, right? And I think one of the things that you're highlighting for me is a lot of these unspoken expectations, but some families you mentioned, like the spoken expectation. And like, what is that? Is that the like, we sacrificed for your opportunity to be here? Like, where does that come from?
Yeah. So I personally have never heard that narrative and I'm thankful for it because I don't think it's a healthy way to kind of have those discussions, but it's definitely something that I hear a lot from my readers and my social media followers.
Yeah.
Of my parents tell me we sacrificed so much. We left family behind to come to a new country to give you better opportunities. Now it's your time to pay us back. Right. So a lot of my readers and followers, they feel the pressure. They feel the guilt. It's heavy. That's why I'm very proud of the work that I put out because although I'm not a psychologist and I don't have all the solutions, I've shared what's worked for me. And part of that is being comfortable being the black sheep because you're doing things differently. So because you're not just doing what you're supposed to do, honoring, let's say, the way things have always been done, you're going to be viewed as like, who are you to be doing things differently? How dare you, right? And again, sometimes that involves being called the black sheep or being treated like it. It sucks, especially because, you know, you love your family and you want to be loyal to them. But again, you have to learn. You have to be that safety net for yourself first, and then you can really support others.
Yeah, being the black sheep in a family is very scary because just like evolutionarily speaking, and I also am not a psychologist, but you and I both have an interest in this, like the structures and the families and the systems, like it's unsafe to be shunned from the group, right? If you think back in early human days.
Caveman days.
Yeah, you want to be accepted. And one of the things I'm curious about too is, you know, when you're becoming that black sheep, I think that the support and things like that, it can be a sign of love, right? Like, I'm supporting you. I'm showing you that I love you. How do you separate the idea of financial support from love in the family? Did that ever come up for you?
I had to be black and white. And again, be comfortable fully being that black sheep of like, do not ask me for anything because I am working on my finances. That definitely led to feelings of being isolated. And it was hard, but the way that I navigated that was I joined a lot of online communities, so mostly on Facebook groups of people also working on their own financial goals. So that helped me feel, okay, I'm not just being greedy. I'm not being selfish. Other people are dealing with this too.
Yeah.
And being surrounded by people constantly being focused on money helped me empower to keep moving forward with my goals.
Yeah. And this is not just, you know, unique to Latin families, right? There are many different first generation families from Indian culture, Persian culture, from Eastern European culture, European culture that have these same sort of challenges to face.
Yeah.
What have you learned from your followers and your readers about different cultural expectations with money that maybe are different from Latin?
Do you watch 90 Day Fiancé?
I have. I love it, but it also stresses me out.
Okay, well, I wrote about it in the book. So the current season right now, it's an American, a white boy dating a Filipina. I've seen this over and over in the show. She is, again, expected in their culture, the Filipina culture, to help her parents financially. They have a business where they have a B&B and they invest money into their building and making it feel like, you know, a little resort. It's nothing crazy fancy, but it's how they make a living, right?
Right.
And the white boy is like, why are you doing this? You're supposed to be focused on our immigration journey and saving for that. And the family gets involved and they're like, this is how we do things. And if you're going to marry our daughter, you're going to have to accept that, you know? So It's something that, again, is definitely not exclusive to the Latino community. It also happens, I would say, to Black Americans. They actually have a name for it. It's called the Black Tax. If you are that one that made it out and is actually doing something with yourself, making good money, people that helped you come up, you're expected to pay them back and to help future generations like your cousins or sister or siblings and definitely your parents. Indian families, I know, feel it too, feel the pressure of having to do the, what's it called? The generational households?
Multi-generational household. Yeah.
Yes. I definitely have seen it with, Asian Americans of you have to honor your family. And part of that is giving back financially. So yeah, it's not something that your typical white middle-class American has to deal with.
I think it's so true. I mean, every culture has its own unique things. And most of what I know is from reality TV. Like that is my education source. And I was just watching Shaws of Sunset's back, but it's called something else, The Valley.
The Valley.
And Reza on that show was talking about how his father taught him about money. Like you never take out credit cards. You never buy what you can't afford. And that was drilled into him. You buy a house, you don't rent, all of these things. And then I also follow Vidya on TikTok, who is one of my favorite creators. She's a brown creator. She's Indian. She is so cute. And she has two kids that are preteen. And they're always reading on planes and going to Kumon. And that's a lot of her content is how much they support her kids' education. And she gets dragged for filth about it all the time. And it's like, that's their culture. And they really value education. And everybody's like, you don't let your kids have any fun. And it's so interesting how we all judge these different experiences, but don't recognize we have our own. So if you had to kind of boil down one of the top three challenges first-gen women are facing, like what are those things that you would have them focus on first?
I would say definitely balancing the way the typical U.S. American does money, again, from learning from those money books, and then the way that collectivist cultures do money, right? Mm-hmm. So for anybody who hasn't read the book or isn't familiar with what I'm talking about, the U.S. money culture is very much about being self-reliant, about being independent, and pulling yourself up by the bootstraps if anything happens financially. Like, it's not okay to be telling people your money problems. It's not okay to be asking others for help because it's very much viewed as a sign of weakness.
Mm-hmm.
So that's literally on the complete opposite end of the spectrum with how a lot of first gen families do money, because they come from a collectivist money culture where money isn't to make just yourself better. It's also communal and is to help extended family. I think the other thing that I see a lot of the challenges is the resistance of the older generations talking about money. It's very much seen as rude. So I always share tips on like how to make this conversation easier to have. I'm like, it's never just going to be one and done. It's going to be several conversations. And I'm like, there's always a time and place. Do not try to have a conversation about what are your plans for retirement, mom and dad, because I need to, you know, see what I'm responsible for at your cousin's wedding or, you know, somebody's quinceañera. It very much has to be in their private home and also prime them for the conversation. Don't just kind of spring it on them, because again, I've experienced myself and heard from other people that it could be received the wrong way as disrespectful and, oh, you're prodding into my financial situation, even though, again, you do expect me to help you retire. So we do need to talk about finances.
Right. We can't just not talk about it. I think you have such a great approach to it, too, because the way that you kind of frame here's how to have that conversation in the book is very soft and it's very respectful. It's, you always lead with respect first is what I found.
My family doesn't think so, but I love hearing that from you.
I'm dead. I love it. No, I think it's really nice because it's helping people. And I think setting the expectation, like you said, like it's not going to be a one and done conversation. Expect to have this come up over and over again. And as I mentioned earlier, I think one of the things that was so striking to me was how over time it felt like you built this muscle of boundaries of not overextending yourself. And I really want to get into some of the tips that you give for first gen women to start supporting themselves and taking care of themselves. Like you said, there was no safety net for you and your family. You had to become your own safety net. So can we talk through some of the first steps people can take to create their own safety net?
Yes. So for me, when I realized I had to be my own safety net and that nobody was going to come and rescue me, I had to put a halt again to that financial support to family. And that's when I honestly became introduced to this notion of boundaries, because in my family, there was no such thing. It's very common in Latino families, and I'm pretty sure in other first-gen households, to be enmeshed where they're too close. They're just in everybody's business, over-dependent on each other, instead of, again, having some of that self-reliance. So what I developed with time was the quiero y puedo approach, which stands for I want to and I can. So that's how I started navigating how and when to set financial boundaries, because I figured, okay, I can't just give and make the progress that I want towards my financial goals, especially as a young person saddled with debt and no generational wealth and doing it all on my own, right? So I developed this method, which made it easier for me to establish boundaries. So the first question is, it's a two-part decision-making process. The first question is, ¿quieres? Do you want to? The reason that that's the first question is because for a long time, I gave money to my family because it was what was expected of me, not because I had the money, not because I wanted to, because I knew that if I said no, I would face backlash and I didn't want to face a backlash, right?
Right.
Then I would see family spending money on things that weren't necessities. So I'm like, wait, I thought you didn't have money and you're asking me for money and I am on a budget. But you here you are spending on a new closet that like is not necessary. So that's why I learned to ask myself, is this an expense you want to help with? If the answer is no, I'll give you an example. For my mom recently, this is a real example that happened this past fall. My uncle reached out and he asked me to help my mom get a new set of tires, which is a big chunk of change. For context, my mom didn't text me herself because my mom and I are not close. So my uncle was doing it on her behalf. And at first I thought it was a joke, because at this point, I'd been practicing boundary setting for a long time. And also, the book had been published for like a year and a half. And they got early access to the book. So I'm like, you clearly haven't read the book because you would know that this is my decision-making process. Yeah. So I said, no, this isn't something I want to help with, especially when I know that my mom just went on a three-week vacation to the UK. So instead of paying for new tires, she either used her money or got into credit card debt to do this trip. So why am I going to enable that behavior? In the book, I share examples of instead of it being a straight up no, you can say, hey, I can't help with all tires, but I can pay for half of them, right? So then that's still some sort of financial support. Or saying, hey, I'm wiped right now. I don't have any extra money to gift or loan, but let me help you do some research on where there are good tire deals, right? So you're helping with your time and knowledge to help them get a good deal that way. So there's different ways to offer support is what I leave my readers with. So if this passes the vibe check, the next question, once you've asked yourself, do you want to do this? And the answer is yes, you move into, that's great. You want to do this, but can you actually afford it?
Right.
Do you have an emergency fund? How are you doing towards retirement investing? Do you have a debt payoff plan? Right. So like, do you check all these boxes where maybe your financial situation isn't perfect, but you're in a solid place where you can help? Then you go ahead and you offer that support like I did for my grandparents. A lot of readers get to that part and they're like, no, I don't. I truly can't afford it, even though I want to. So again, that's when I offer the solutions of helping with smaller amounts or helping with your time or sharing resources. Because again, there's not just one way to help. There's several ways to help if you still care for family.
And you talk about something that I'm also obsessed with in the book, which are sinking funds. Can you talk about what it would look like to set up a separate family support fund?
Yeah. So I have a lot of readers that have implemented that. So I think it can be dangerous to dip into your own emergency fund for other people's emergency funds. So if you know that you're going to be constantly tapped by family, and again, you want to support and you have the financial means to support, create a separate emergency fund just for family. We have something like that for my in-laws, and then my dad's in that pot too, because I have a great relationship for my dad. So we have like a $5,000 emergency fund where if they need help paying a deductible for, you know, some sort of medical procedure or some sort of emergency, we have money there that's separate from our own. So I think that's important. And, you know, that can take time to build. So it's about, you know, repeating those good habits and being patient and knowing that it's something that's important to you and it will keep you financially whole while still giving you the ability to support others.
What I love about the framework here is you give really tactical advice. Like, I love that setting up a separate fund. But, you know, you mentioned this at the top of the show, like some of the traditional American advice was just not working for you. So like, why do you think traditional budgets are failing first-gen women?
Because they don't have that cultural nuance. They don't have that lived experience of how things are done differently in other cultures with other ethnicities. So I'm really thankful of the times we're living in now in 2026, because when I was consuming money books back in 2018, 2019, there were only the Dave Ramseys and Susie Ormans. Yeah. So to now be 2026, we've had a huge wave of diverse authors enter the personal finance space and bring their lived experience and share how they navigate these sort of cultural nuances. And it's a game changer. When I was going through my stuff, you know, they talk about things like, oh, what to do when you get a windfall. I was like, what the heck is a windfall? Oh, it's when you receive unexpected money, like when your grandma passes. And I'm like, I am not receiving money when my grandma passes. If anything, I want to have to pitch in for the burial costs. Like, right. What is this windfall? Yeah. So a lot of stuff was unrelatable. And again, it made me resentful of how some people had it easier. People will always have things easier, right? That's just the society we live in, unfortunately. So I'm really excited. I always say it to my students and readers. I'm like, I'm so jealous that you get to learn from diverse authors that look like you or have had lived experiences like yours, because I'm like, it was rough back in the day when there wasn't much diversity in this space.
100%. And, you know, one of the things, like you're talking about, like a windfall, like what is that? I think one of the things that you are really great at addressing too is that feeling of being behind. Like many first-gen women feel behind. Yes. Number one, with the financial education, it just doesn't exist in a context that they can relate to. But when we talk about the brass tacks of like getting started or, you know, feeling late, First of all, how do you reframe that mentally, emotionally?
Yeah. So when I realized that for myself before I wrote the book, it felt very liberating because I thought that it was my fault that I was behind and others were several steps ahead. And then I realized, no, it's not my fault. I've done the right thing. I've gone to college, gotten a nice office job, right, with a 401k. I've checked all those boxes. But some people just got lucky and they were born into a family with more access, more privilege, right? And my parents as immigrants, right? Most immigrants come to the U.S. with very limited means. So of course, they're not going to have the generational wealth to pass on when they came here for better opportunities. Of course, teaching their first-gen children isn't top of mind when they're in a new country, learning a new language, adapting to a new way of life, when they don't know the financial system themselves, you know? So that's why those teachings don't get passed on to first gen, and we have to undertake that learning ourselves. Because, yeah, I mean, I definitely had a lot of classmates in college, like Reza that you mentioned from the Valley Persian style of, oh, well, my parents taught me I need to do this with my credit card, or I need to invest at this age. And I'm like, what? Like, my parents have actually dissuaded me from investing because they said that the stock market is risky and you can lose all your money, right? So a lot of unlearnings like that, for sure.
When we talk about a first-gen woman, I mean, first of all, the first step is obviously to get the book and read it, because it goes through everything from the familial pressure to how to get yourself set up with your own safety net and your own financial habits, and then how to get actually started. What's the best first, simple, whatever you want to call it, entry point to getting to building wealth?
So I focus on my first-gen five. So focusing on building an emergency fund and having savings. Second, having a debt payoff plan. Third, budgeting and embracing budgeting as a spending plan. Four, learning how to build a healthy credit score. And then five, learning how to invest and build long-term wealth and debunking a lot of these myths that we grew up with about the stock market and other financial institutions. So I realized that the reason that those five worked was because, again, I wasn't teaching everything under the sun about personal finance. That would be too overwhelming for a beginner reader. And because I also saw that it's a holistic approach to money, because taking care of paying off debt, that's your past money life. Taking care of budgeting now is your current money life. And then investing for the future, working on your credit score, that's also towards future money you. So they kind of, again, encompass all three versions of you. And it because so many people just focus on paying off debt. Some people focus on just investing. But again, I really see it as a garden. And you kind of have to water the garden evenly and not just water the tomatoes and completely ignore the rest of the garden. And it's like all wilting and dried up because you're just focused on one.
I think that's so key. And I want to dovetail this point, because this is my favorite part of the book, into kind of talking about your rich life now and what you're doing. Like, you're a published author, you're living abroad, living your best life. But the section that I really liked was something that I've never actually articulated for myself or for my listeners, which is, how does it actually feel to be debt-free? Because I, like you, girl, was constantly in debt since I was 17. I just thought I was always going to have that. And then you do this really great, there's a little section in the book about, like, what does it actually feel like to be debt-free? Because when you're in it, you don't know that it feels different. And it feels so different. So some of the things that you said that were real for you after you became debt-free is that you had more space to work on things that excite you, because any money that was being taken up for paying back debt is now freed up for you to use as you wish. Less stress about money, because you have that burden lifted off your shoulders, like avoiding your toxic roommate situation, not having to make choices to sacrifice your comfort. But this was the one that I liked. Increased flexibility and lifestyle choices. You say yes to you. You decide where you live, what moves you can make. And it was the reason why you were able to quit your stable corporate job to become a full-time TikToker. So tell us about your life now. Where are you living? What are you doing? Like, tell us everything.
Yeah. So in the outro for the book, I address this and I say the version of me that you've read only exists in this book. Now, thanks to the financial choices and the opportunities that I've had and the new money habits I adopted, right? I am able to live a more financially abundant life. No, I'm not a millionaire yet, but I do have financial stability, which is something I did not have for a long time, especially through my chaotic 20s, which is where I focus most of the book on. I'm not rich yet. I'm not financially independent yet. I still have to show up to work to make a paycheck. I live a rich life in my own way because I only work part-time now. Because I've moved to Spain, the cost of living is a bit cheaper. So I'm able to scale back on work and still make enough to pay the bills. I also want to acknowledge I share expenses with my spouse, right? So that helps. So yeah, I work part-time. I typically work, let's say, 16 to 20 hours a week. I also, because of that, I have slow mornings, right? So the mornings are for me. The mornings are for me to have cook a nutritious breakfast, not just have like some quick granola bar because I have to get to work. Prioritize my wellness by going to the gym and getting a workout in. So it's really a luxury to be living abroad and to have the ability to live abroad. Because again, before I couldn't even switch apartments because I had no money. And now I've been able to switch continents, right?
It's incredible. I love your story. I want to get into some rapid fire rich girl questions to get your hot takes on a few things. But before we do, I didn't even tell you this before, but I love this book so much. I want to do a giveaway. So we're going to post on Instagram and I'm going to put something together and Gigi, I'll tag you in it, of course, so that you can share it. I'm going to give away 3 books. I will buy them for our winners of the giveaway and send them out because this is such a good story and has so much value in it. So thank you for contributing.
That's so kind. Thank you so much for supporting my work.
Absolutely. So let's get into our rapid fire rich girl questions. What comes to mind first when I say, what was the biggest money lesson you had to unlearn?
That I didn't have to keep lighting myself on fire to keep others warm. So again, this notion of, yeah, it's okay to put your oxygen mask first and then help others. That's not something I grew up with. If anything, it's a complete opposite. You're supposed to sacrifice it all, no matter if it's at your expense, for your family. And as a bicultural Latina, I reject that. As a bicultural first-gen woman, I reject that. And I say, because we belong to both cultures, we can learn how to balance both. It might not make everybody happy, but it's what's going to be best for you to still accomplish financial goals and then also feel that you are still honoring traditions in a sense.
Gorgeous. What is the most underrated wealth habit in your opinion?
Definitely building systems.
Yes, same sis.
Yeah, automation. I know that the Automatic Millionaire, David Bach, was a big game changer for me and of learning the power of automation instead of leaving it to you of like, you need to make this transfer for this savings goal or for this debt payoff. Having that automatically done as soon as your money comes in is just making life easier and it makes it happen on autopilot.
Willpower and brain power are limited. So automate everything.
Totally.
Okay. What does financial peace mean to you now?
Financial peace means not having to worry about not having enough money to cover an emergency. I lived through a lot of that in my 20s. Also, it means having the ability to prioritize myself and choose my wellness, my safety over making money or things like that.
What is your favorite rich woman ritual?
Honestly, I would say my slow mornings. I know that it's something that a lot of people don't get to experience until retirement. So the fact that I get to be young and live that now and kind of peek into what retirement looks like is really exciting. And I feel very thankful for that.
I love that. And the last one is, what is the last thing you invested in for yourself?
Ooh, this is recent. A Pilates membership. I've always wanted to do Pilates. Yes. And in the US, it's always been so expensive. Here, it's a fraction of the cost, but it's still $100 a month. Before, in my broke era that I like to call back to, I would have never been able to afford that. So investing in my health through a Pilates membership has been really invigorating for sure.
Amazing. Tell everyone where they can find more of you. You've got all of this great content out there. Where can they go to connect with you?
Thanks. Yes. So I am active on Instagram, TikTok, and LinkedIn. I also have a podcast called Cultura en Cash that complements the book. You can access my handles and the link to the podcast at my website, which is thefirstgenmentor.com. And if you listen to this episode, feel free to DM me and be like, hey, I heard you on the Old Money podcast. You know, so I'd love to hear from listeners.
Thank you so much for spending time with us on Old Money Podcast. We will be in touch.
Thanks, Amber.
Look at you investing in your rich life one episode at a time. You're not just listening, you're leveling up. If you have questions, comments, thoughts, or prayers, slide into my inbox at oldmoneypodcast@gmail.com or in my DMs on Instagram at oldmoneypodcast. If this episode made you laugh, think, or write down a single note, please do me a solid and rate, review, and subscribe. It takes less time than your morning scroll, and it helps this show reach more future millionaires. And speaking of growing the network, please share this with your ambitious bestie, your business buddy, or your secretly rich aunt. Please share the gospel of Old Money, and I will be more grateful than a trust fund kid on distribution day. Thank you for being here. I'm rooting for your bank account, and I will catch you on the next episode of Old Money. Remember, I am not your lawyer, I am not your tax professional, and I am not your financial advisor. The content presented in this podcast is intended to entertain, educate, inspire, and support listeners and their personal and professional development and does not constitute business, financial, or legal advice.